Welcome to Fresh Take, where we at Florida Organic Growers speak to food systems experts about topics related to organic and sustainable agriculture, healthy lifestyles, and the environment. To help us continue our programs at FOG, including our podcast, consider becoming a sponsor. For more information on sponsorship, check out our Get Involved page on our website, www.foginfo.org.
Hello, and welcome to our part two episode on Feeding the Revolution Through Food Sovereignty on Fresh Take. Today, I am joined by two very special guests, Nicole Brand and Will Schombacher, both of whom I have personally known for several years now and had the pleasure of collaborating with on separate projects. Nicole and Will currently work at the University of South Florida and have slightly different but related roles that we will get into shortly. Welcome to the show, Nicole and Will.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I feel like I know the two of you quite well, but there's always something new to learn. And obviously today we have a really important topic to dive into. But first, I'd like to start with understanding how you both got into the topic of food.
Well, yeah, this is an interesting one for me personally. I was not always interested in food. In fact, when I was going through school, graduate school in particular, I was more interested in ethical issues related to global poverty, that big picture kind of thing. And it was only after kind of exploring the nature of hunger within global poverty that I started to understand that this was a particularly acute form of human suffering. So that really caught my attention. And once I started diving in deeply, I'm in the field of religious studies. I saw this connection between all global religions and this idea of feeding the poor, taking care of the poor, but also sort of food in general was a prominent theme in many, you know, the stories all over the place in world religions. And so I saw this connection and a way to maybe talk about global poverty and hunger through the lens of food. So that's really kind of how I got started.
Yeah, I love that.
And I like to think my journey through food is always, it's taken several forms, but food has always been the common theme. I remember my very first research paper in eighth grade was on the ethics of patent technology and the story of Canadian farmer Percy Schmeiser and genetic materials and ownership of those materials in food grown. And that interest turned into, I guess, more of an interest in cooking with my grandmother growing up and having a wide variety of introductions into Southern food, Southern vegetarian food, which was a novel concept when my mother became a vegetarian.
Yeah.
When I was, I believe, 12 or 13. And then I spent quite a bit of time when I was in college exploring different avenues of food growing. My freshman year, I ended up taking some time off and moving to Scotland. And I lived in an eco-village called Findhorn, where much of the food was produced on site and the ecological principles of living and sustainably living were explored through a wide variety of avenues. And that was eye-opening for me. And elements like communal living, or even what it looks like when you have a common language around conflict negotiation, the formal style that we utilized at Findhorn was nonviolent communication, and just having a common language for how you solve problems and what that means for a community when you're essentially fighting with the same rules. And then moving further on in like post-college, pre-graduate school, I spent some time in Tonga with a farmer on Aoa named Latu, who specifically grew, he studied agricultural sciences in nearby New Zealand and grew food subsistent for his community, but also for the king that was shipped off as a part of their economic value of the country, as a part of global farming. And seeing the role of the global farming system and how what that meant for countries small and large. And finally, kind of firming my interests, and actually where Lana and I graduated together from the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine in a degree in food systems and society.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning that. I was just about to say, for those listening who might not know the both of us, we met before that graduate program, but wow, I mean, I think both of your backgrounds and kind of journeys to food and understanding the critical importance of, you know, how this impacts everyone on a daily basis is so diverse, but so interesting. And it's so fun to learn how people in my, you know, in my social circles have all come to understand the impact of food on society. And, you know, each of us come from a very diverse backgrounds, even culturally, and understanding how food impacts us. Even Nicole, like you said, during your time in Scotland, that the methods that you guys use to communicate, like all of that really ties into food as well. And I think people always think of food as a separate concept, but really it's tied into everything. And I know, Nicole, for instance, you have a background also in communications and conservation. And Will, you also are an author and have you know, written about food sovereignty in some of your books as well. So I want to talk more about the topic for today. And in part one of this episode, we covered the history and concept of food sovereignty. But just to remind folks about what it is, food sovereignty is defined as the right of people to control their own food system. And you might be thinking, well, how does that work? But well, people make decisions about what they eat, how it's produced, and who benefits from it. And really the central idea of food sovereignty is putting people at the center and promoting the idea that everyone has the right to healthy and culturally appropriate food that is produced in a sustainable and just manner. So for the people listening to this episode, Nicole, could you tell me why this is an important topic for people to know about and how does it impact us?
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you jogged my memory for when we first met. Yeah, you're right. We first met in 2016. I'd received a full scholarship through the Good Food Jobs, which is an online blog and a platform. It's run by Dorothy and Taylor. And I mention them because they've been a really interesting case study in thinking through, and you can see it happen in real time, specifically in, you know, what is important for the American public specifically to know about food and who does it impact, and the way that they've shifted their job posting practices from eliminating even unpaid internships as something that they offer, or even below wage internships that were offered on the platform. So I think that's really interesting that you brought that up. But the full scholarship that I received was actually for the New York City Eco Practicum through the School of Ecological Justice, which is another amazing example that Lana and I witnessed and participated in together.
That's right.
In discussing the importance and impact of food around us. I remember, do you remember our very first excursion as a collective group? And the goal was to learn about really the role of waste and how much waste that was specifically still healthy, good to eat, not past date. Do you remember our very first dumpster diving experience?
Yes, I was just about to say, we went dumpster diving in New York, which to say that out loud sounds kind of crazy, but it was a really mind-blowing experience and in a really good way.
Yeah, and really underlined kind of the role of a food system and a system that has no really no sovereignty in it, right? So food that is still edible is not making its way to people who can and would eat it. And it was just one demonstration, mm-hmm. almost like a gimmicky way to demonstrate that relationship to us, but one that definitely has been burned in my memory for the rest of time.
That is a really good example of that, actually. And to to see in front of our faces bags full of unopened food, perfectly good food, unexpired food, and not getting into the hands of folks that are going hungry is what was quite devastating. How does that tie into our food system now in terms of how it's, basically you're saying it's pretty much not along the lines of food sovereignty. So how does it look like now versus what a food sovereign system would look like?
Right. So that one's demonstrating one of there's no mechanism of localized control, right? So were there local and regional decisions made specific to what that food was, where it came from? Again, that was a gimmicky way of, and extrapolates quite further. It was just a dumpster, I believe, outside of, you know, a major high rise in New York City. But the demonstration of that juxtaposed with, say, some community farms that were, you know, a mile or two away that we also visited, where they were growing demonstration crops that were specific to the cultures within the geographic region. There were plots that were specifically grown after community conversations in deciding what would you purchase at this pantry. And Lana, I don't know if you remember this either, but the pantry was one that was the very first conceptual understanding that I ever had of the concept of food with dignity, where the experience of going to that community garden and food pantry was one where there was a good understanding of what the culturally appropriate foods were in the area. And instead of just receiving a bag, families and individuals had the opportunity to essentially have a grocery store experience where they're picking from foods that they would already have chosen, ones that they knew how to prepare, ones that they were comfortable with, and even reminiscent in culturally appropriate areas. For example, you know, not providing something like kale to a community that historically didn't eat it and didn't necessarily want to or know how to prepare it.
Right, right. Yes, actually, that was one of the first experiences I witnessed as well in terms of dignity. And thank you for mentioning that, because I think that's one of the key pieces of this movement, is the right to food and having that kind of dignity. And Will, I would like to hear about, you know, this movement started as a peasant movement. And I think peasant has sometimes a negative connotation, because, you know, people think of that as being, you know, the lowest class of society. But in reality, the peasants are those that bring us our food. They're the ones that are harvesting and doing all of the hard labor every single day to enable us to have food on our plates, you know, when we get home. So in terms of our food system structure, how does food sovereignty impact us on, you know, a national scale? We talked about kind of localized impacts, but what does it look like on a national and even a global scale?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll actually begin with the global level, because that was the kind of the subject or the scope of my first book, The Politics of Food, The Global Conflict Between Food Security and Food Sovereignty. Really looking at, and you mentioned the issue of waste. I'm really glad the cover of that book is actually just this big pile of food that has been thrown away, going to waste, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of rice and various things going to waste. And that is a really kind of telling picture that represents the global food system. The way that it is structured right now, we waste so much food, and the distribution methods are structured in such a way that we're really kind of throwing away a lot of food that could be eaten, right? So this is going to play into that discussion about dignity. But more importantly, on a global level, this is, as you mentioned, began as a peasant, small-scale, landless farmers and fisher folk movement that really started to kind of take matters into their own hands. There was land that was being unused. There was water that was part of all of our, you know, sort of existence. Vandana Shiva, I had the pleasure of meeting her, who fights for the rights of global women farmers who produce the majority of our food, talks about the commons, things like air, water, and land. And the global food sovereignty movement really takes that to heart and says, this is something that is given to us and is available for all of us, not to be owned, not to be simply used for profit and exploitation. And so that's kind of the fundamental belief of food sovereignty as a sort of peasant or landless movement. But yes, you're right. It's been given sort of that negative connotation, but in reality, it is living by what, you know, has been kind of provided for us in whatever form that might be.
Right.
And so coincidentally, this is one of the reasons why I became interested. Nicole, you mentioned the Percy Schmeiser case. That was actually one of those cases that really stood out to me. We talk about food sovereignty and our autonomy and our ability to produce our own food. The Schmeiser case is a perfect example of how we've lost control of that. Here we have this Canadian farmer who is simply trying to farm, you know, mind his own business. And because of the way that genetically modified foods, seeds in particular, as Vandana Shiva calls them, the building blocks of life, right, were something that he wanted to continue using, that he had grown and produced and harvested the seeds I'm talking about here for generations. And he didn't want to have to buy genetically modified foods. But because of the way nature works with the wind and the birds carrying seeds, his particular farm was contaminated with seeds that were genetically modified. And, it plays out into this big sort of, court case. But the kind of the moral of that story is he lost his autonomy, not because of decisions he made, but because of decisions made by the corporate and industrial food system. And so that kind of is a good example of how that plays out. Now, we find this here in the United States on a local level. One, we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic how we were, dumping food on the side of highways. Farmers were raising their entire fields because they had no one to distribute the food to when our restaurants and stores were closing down. So that kind of showed in particular the precarity of our national food system. And really to kind of, just reiterate what Nicole was saying, the need to reconsider localized food systems and how we can, re-envision what that might look like. And I think just from my perspective as a researcher and community engaged researcher for that matter, is taking those concepts that we found in peasant, small scale and landless global farmers and translating them into innovative, novel projects here in the United States in our particular context to see how we can realize food sovereignty here in our local communities. And that's kind of what we do at USF with my Urban Food Sovereignty Group.
Yes. And actually, I was just about to say, I can't wait to dive into talking about some of the localized examples of food sovereignty that you are doing in Tampa Bay area. And I would like to cover kind of also your current role. I know you are currently the assistant professor in religious studies, but you are also the director of the Urban Food Sovereignty Group. So can you tell us a little bit about your current role in that as well?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Religious Studies. And in terms of my teaching, I've developed over the last decade, really, courses that are related to religion and food, religion in the global food system, religion in American foodways, all looking at kind of the different ways religion in particular plays a role in kind of how we think about food. But as the director of the USF Urban Food Sovereignty Group, which was founded in 2019, we've expanded that curriculum to include courses on regenerative agriculture, food justice, and other courses, related to health and food. So that's been an exciting endeavor and really a way in which we're kind of expanding the curriculum and the educational opportunities. We were recently awarded a National Endowment for the Humanities grant, a planning grant to establish a new center on food studies at USF, looking at food sovereignty, in which we have over 20 courses that have agreed to look at how they might include a food sovereignty module or component into that. So we're really excited about kind of expanding sort of just the educational side of food sovereignty. But on our research side, we're currently engaged in a United States Department of Agriculture grant on building a food sovereignty toolkit. So on the ground, practical guide to how communities can think about concepts in food sovereignty and apply them in effective ways to reduce food insecurity in their own communities, but do it, as you all have been talking about, with a sense of dignity. And this involves really the community educating us, participating in co-led, co-researched events and practices that we are really working hand in hand, the university and the community learning together rather than sort of that top-down model that we generally see university and community relationships being in the past. So this is really a novel, unique thing that the Urban Food Sovereignty Group is doing. And this food sovereignty toolkit will be something that in our particular communities are unique to those specific locales, but ideally will provide a template in which anybody across the nation can start to apply food sovereignty principles to exploring new ways to improve the food system within their local neighborhoods and communities.
Wow. Congratulations on that endowment, by the way. That is, I think, monumental, because this is a topic that I don't think is getting enough attention in general. And to have, you know, a special endowment dedicated to this, I think is really critical for people to understand what it means, what it looks like, and actually put in more work and more research into this kind of thing. So it's really great to hear about the Urban Food Sovereignty Group and kind of what you guys are doing in the community and how you're getting people involved, you know, hands-on with these urban agricultural classes and also building this new food sovereignty toolkit. So I'm interested in knowing first, what sparked this group? How did it come about? What were the reasons that you guys decided to create this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really did begin about a decade ago with my colleague, Mr. Del Deschant, who's really been integral to the entire process from the beginning. He's been teaching at USF for over 30 years and teaches courses on religion and the environment. He has a course in that curriculum called Agrarianism and the Sacred. So he teaches about agrarian principles. And we were the first group to actually come up with the idea of building a course, a hands-on course at the USF Botanical Gardens. So I think in 2014, we launched that pilot project and we're still teaching it today. So that's been exciting to kind of show students, you know, how to grow their own food. So that's been quite a ride. But from there, we really recognize that this is not something that is just in the Department of Religious Studies. In fact, when you look at food sovereignty, it's often in different departments and different disciplines. And as we started, you know, kind of sharing our thoughts, we realized that there were so many other professors at USF who were interested in this same idea from their different disciplinary fields. So really, in the last few years, it has grown. We have over, I think, 15 faculty members, everywhere from the College of Public Health to nursing to the Department of Sociology, history, cultural studies, all the way to the School of Hospitality and the MUMA College of Business. So you really can see that food sovereignty is something and that people from all different backgrounds are interested in and have something to add to the equation. And so that's what's really exciting, is the true interdisciplinary nature of our group. And on top of that, perhaps equally important, is the fact that we are able to kind of bring that different disciplinary knowledge to share with community members, who in turn kind of teach us, well, this is how sociologists, this is how religious studies scholars, this is how business folks, this is how nurses and doctors should be thinking about this, because this is our lived reality when it comes to the food system in our community. And so that really, again, is testament to the co-researcher and co kind of facilitator nature of the group itself.
Yeah. And that's so powerful, I think, to have those other departments involved and, you know, like you just said, learning from each other about how it impacts each aspect of, you know, sociology and all of these different fields that one might not think food sovereignty has an impact on, but in reality, it really does. And then talking about collaboration and looking at different fields that food impacts, Nicole, I'd like to learn more about what your role entails as the director of ECOR. Can you tell us a little bit about what ECOR system is and what you are overseeing?
Sure. So the ECOR system is known as the Environmental and Conservation Outreach Research and Education System, which is a mouthful and why it's just listed as the ECOR system. That concept is actually housed within the College of Arts and Sciences, specifically within the Office of Research and Scholarship. And I oversee the environmental and botanical assets of the College of Arts and Sciences. Now, what's interesting about this specific role is it's newly created and approved by the Board of Governors in Florida. And this was in part created as a reaction to, there is a parcel of land on the northeast part of campus, and it's called the Forest Preserve. It's this beautiful 500 acres of sandhill, mostly wetland habitat. And this particular parcel, the former president decided to just casually see if he put out a quiet little RFI, or request for information, for ideas for development of, specific to the Sand Hill area. And there was a beautiful reaction from the community, from staff, faculty, students, and the current president, President Rhea Law, made the decision to eliminate the possibility and close the idea of the RFI and work to create this very position that I'm in right now with the College of Arts and Sciences. So what's interesting, and to speak to the interdisciplinary nature of food sovereignty, that Will's work and the many different, what did you say, over 20 different classes that it reaches into, I find that the work in the Forest Preserve does similarly has veins in several different areas. When you're thinking about food sovereignty, you can think about maybe the choices of food, or there's so many different lenses that you can look through. And I think a very interesting take on that is also, when you're thinking of a right to food, are we also thinking about a right to water and water supply? For example, this very preserve that we sit on, that's in the northeast part of campus, if you follow the Hillsborough River all the way back up, it'll take you to the Green Swamp. And the Green Swamp is an area in Florida. Florida's a little bit different. Normally, you would follow your watershed, protect your watershed. But because Florida sits on karst, it's very porous, the watersheds are actually governed more, not as watersheds, but as water management districts. So we have the Southwest Florida Water Management District, which is the area that we're specifically in. And the Hillsborough River accounts for the majority of drinking water that is distributed across the Tampa Bay area. And when you're thinking of Florida in general, 62% of the total water withdrawn is used for purposes like drinking water and agricultural irrigation. So, you know, if you're thinking further back in all of the different veins that that might fall into and different disciplines, then of course, what is a right to water? What is the right to water for, you know, your control of your own food system? It's also a floodplain area. So that particular parcel of land, anything that flows down the Hillsborough River, it's one of the last filters before it hits the Tampa Bay area, making it an incredibly important parcel of land. And again, another factor in thinking through in a right to water, a right to access to water, but a right to safe, clean water, or access to areas that are safe from storm surge.
Right, right. So that this pretty much touches on the relationship between land, food, and conservation. I mean, water is pretty key in tying all of these things together. So how do you entice people to appreciate and preserve these kinds of connections, especially during our state of climate change?
Well, I think from a personal perspective, I might say, go do a forest bathe. That's a Japanese physiological and psychological exercise, I think coined in the 1980s, that translates to taking in the forest atmosphere and all of its elements. So consciously connecting with the natural world around you, kind of defining internally what your relationship is with that world and what lens you might view that world and what benefits does it bring to you and how can you honor that? But that's just from the personal perspective. And I wanted to ask you, even from the very nature of bringing the conversation in, for example, like water and drinking supplies, that was something that I found as a connection and a thread into the food sovereignty world. But does it have, is there a credible thread into the food sovereignty world around access to drinking water and water for irrigation?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you look at the sort of original out of La Via Campesina and the original food sovereignty global movement, we add that, which often is forgotten, fisher folk communities, as it's kind of called, but all of the coastal communities, rivers, you know, people that live by the water and the seas in particular. So they're that, you know, drinking water, but just water as a source of life is, I think, integral to food sovereignty. And so when we talk about that, as Lana mentioned, right, we can't talk about land, we can't talk about food production without that conversation about water and water as something that is common to all of us.
I think research is also a critical part of all of this too. And I know that within eCore, there's a lot of research going on in terms of identifying connections between food and other aspects of health as well. So could you talk about some of the research that's going on as well, Nicole?
Sure. And I think I'd like to start just by talking about one that I'm very excited about, Dr. Schoenbacher's recent grant award. There's tremendous opportunity there because, as we've talked about, these are localized and regionalized conversations with specific lenses. Of course, there always needs to be a practical application to that process as well. And right now, Dr. Schoenbacher has classes over at the Botanical Gardens and work within the Tampa Bay area community. And of course, when you have something like buildable land on a specific parcel that's, say, governed by a university, I think that's an area where the eCourse system, and specifically my role and background, can really bring some assistance into the research and education component. For example, by nature of having land that you can build on and, say, work the earth and create a garden, there are still, no matter what, you have these mountains of layers of protection that you need to think through. And in a former role that I had with the Pinellas, in the Pinellas County school system, specifically at Pinellas Technical College, I helped create the very first school in Pinellas County to have a gap gift certification with the USDA government. And that's the Good Agriculture Practices and Good Handling Practices, which expands the opportunities with how that food can be distributed, and I think serves as an excellent learning platform. So navigating, though I love to stay kind of in the beauty of theory there, there's a lot of practical application, not just in the red tape, but also the practical application of working the earth that I think certainly makes Will's work and the eCourse system a very good fit in moving forward. So I'm exceptionally pleased with what our potential is for the future.
Yeah, and I love that phrase, working the earth. I think that's so, that says a lot. And in doing it in a way that's obviously respectful to our planet and understanding what it's providing us and how we can provide it as well. And so I'd like to talk about, in terms of the future, what are some of the impacts that you guys have seen thus far in some of the projects that you guys are doing through eCore, through the Urban Food Sovereignty Group? How are you seeing that relayed in your local community?
I've got a great example, and it really kind of ties in with what Nicole just said. One of the special groups in my particular neighborhood is a group called the Healthy 22nd Street Garden Initiative. This is a project within the Coalition of Community Gardeners. And the Healthy 22nd Street Gardeners is this group of women in East Tampa, where I live, who just a year ago started gardening with these really innovative food grade barrels that we've cut in half and turned into, modified into, self-watering little home gardens. So speaking of water, it's very water efficient. You can fill these things up with, you know, a jug of, you know, an empty jug of milk that you've, you know, just poured water into, and they water, they're self-wicking. So they water from the bottom, and you'd be amazed at the amount of food that we can produce in just a small piece of, or a small area. And they're movable, they're mobile. So you can, if you don't have a yard, you can put them on your deck. And this project, what's really special is, one, we've developed just this great family. I was actually talking with one of the members yesterday, asking her, you know, what is this, you know, Healthy 22nd Street group meant to you? And she said, well, I wouldn't call it a group. I would call it a family, because we've become so close, and we've become close in sharing our stories about what we've grown, to sharing recipes, to really understanding how it has impacted people's health. In fact, right? Gardening can be calming. For me personally, it has affected my mental health in the sense that I've just grown a greater sense of appreciation for my particular community, but we're also growing food and saving people money. So this is just a really innovative project that is cost efficient, doesn't cost much money, but saves money, builds community, and is something that can be replicable. We could do this all over the city and really all over the nation. So I'm really excited about this particular group. A big shout out to the women of the Healthy 22nd Street Garden Initiative. But, you know, on a very serious note, you know, look to big things like this that really could change the way we think about the food system.
And if we're shouting out to roles of women and as the nurturers and holders of the food system movement historically, I've got a tale as well. I remember fresh out of my program, out of the master's that Lana and I, the program that we were in, as a part of the Pinellas Technical College Food Systems Center that we launched in order to create the St. Pete Youth Farm, we were working with some local groups to create a small educational garden for a group called the Gathering of Women. And I remember, you know, I come with my theories and all of this book work that I've done, and I'm diving into the practical application of it. And I'm like, here's what we're going to do. And I got a scolding. We'll call it a scolding that was along the lines of, that's really cute, and I appreciate your help. And also, we know what we need. And so what that translated into in the production of this beautiful garden that does still exist to this day was the understanding that that theory to practical, there's such a disconnect in the messiness of how you actually get the work done. And what I needed to do was just take a giant heap of humility and step back and listen. And I will say that's turned into a longstanding friendship. That was back in, I think, 2016 or 2017. And here we are, fast friends to this day with the Gathering of Women. So it really is a role, I think, in humility and like truly, as you said, Will, you mentioned family and deep friendship for me.
Yeah, I think that's such a great example. Thank you guys for sharing that. I think that something that we often don't realize is that the knowledge is already there. People have been doing this for centuries, have been, you know, growing food in ways that are beneficial to the planet for such a long time. And the knowledge is accessible. But in terms of our food system today, it's overseen, and we're trying to find different methods and different technological approaches to creating a sustainable system. But in reality, I think a lot of what we're looking for is already there. So, you know, tapping into those relationships and the people who have been at the core of the system is really crucial. And I'd like to end this conversation with talking about really quickly, you know, how can people get more involved? And I want this to cover even other universities and just folks listening in terms of, are there resources out there where people can learn about how to create or how to participate in food sovereignty efforts? You know, are there tools and guides that we can share with our listeners?
Well, I think we've just learned that the easiest first step is to go bug your resident professor who's deep in the theory, research, and practical application of food sovereignty, right, Will?
I love it. Thank you. Thanks, Nicole. Well, yes, but more. I think that would be something. And what we're trying to do with the Urban Food Sovereignty Group is really create a model that other universities could use. So this is not going to be something that, you know, is patented, you know, or, you know, privatized. I mean, this is the building a food sovereignty toolkit. The very nature of that is such that it's going to be different in whatever community that you're in, because all communities are different. So I would urge, at least from the university perspective, those who are interested in the food system to consider engaging in more community-based participatory research. Now, that's difficult to do because it takes time. It involves being with the community, not in the community. It might even involve moving, living, you know, in the areas that you want to build food sovereignty in. So it's a big commitment, but it's worthwhile. I can say personally, it's something that has changed my life. But you can also do smaller things too. You know, develop a course at the university. Talk to your neighbors about, you know, whether or not they have interest in gardening. As we mentioned before, it all, you know, is the success of any sort of food sovereignty initiative is going to depend on whether or not particular communities are interested in growing their own food or learning more about their food system. So thankfully for all of us involved, this is something that doesn't cost a lot of money. It starts with just building relationships within the community, talking more about food, sharing our experiences about how food is connected to everything from local farmers to our fast food workers to our own personal health. So, you know, start small is my kind of advice at this point.
And no matter where I
I move, every time I move somewhere new in this world, some of the very first steps I take is to reach out to, you know, who's growing locally. You know, I'm a little more extroverted maybe than most. So if I see somebody's growing in their yard, I might, and I see that they're watering things, I might stop and ask questions. When I first moved to St. Pete, one of the first people I met was Bill Bilodeau, who at the time was the president of the Sustainable Urban Agriculture Coalition there. And from there, just formed relationships with other groups that had affiliations and working in various components within growing food. Timebanks.org, there's a chapter that specifically ran out of Pinellas County, where there were a plethora of opportunities to, say, do everything from gleaning, say if somebody had a bumper crop of mangoes in the summer, everybody gets together as a community and harvests them together. So there are many different avenues that are actually outside of the traditional thought of, you know, finding a growing group where you find that intersection of food and community.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly it, is finding that intersection and building those relationships, because, you know, we can't get anywhere if we don't talk to each other, right? So I think, you know, today's episode is just an example of how communicating and speaking on these topics can just inspire people, because I feel inspired already. And honestly, it was such a joy having both of you on the show, especially discussing this topic that I feel so connected to. Your work is critical for directing us on a more food sovereign path. So thank you both for doing what you do, for joining us and sharing the impacts that you are producing. It's really awesome.
Thank you very much. Onward we go.
Thank you, Lana. Happy to be here.
Thank you to our listeners for supporting us and tuning in to the second part of a two-part series on food sovereignty. We hope you continue to listen in for some informative conversations and tools to equip us for living healthier and more dignified lifestyles. Until next time.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Florida Organic Growers is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So to keep our content available and free to the public, we need your help. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen, and consider making a tax-deductible donation or become a sponsor. Learn more about our work and how you can become a sponsor from our website, www.foginfo.org.